This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Rabia here, and I'm joined this week with now a very regular co-host with Jahat Ali. Hey, Waj.
Well, welcome. I'm just curious whether or not we'll get to swear in this episode.
Oh, we can. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that scandal that arose in the past week. But I want to first apologize a little bit to our listeners. We're dropping this episode a little bit late. First of all, I'm kind of almost feeling better, but I lost my voice for a while. I think Susan might still be fighting kangaroos in Australia. I really don't even know where she is. So anyway, I'm glad, Waj, you could join me. But I'm also very excited because we have a new guest this week who's never been on before, and somebody I've known for a few years. And Jahat, you know him as well. So let me introduce him. This week, we have joining us Qasim Rashid. Now, Qasim is a human rights attorney. If you follow me on Twitter, there's no way you don't know who he is. He is very prolific on social media. He tweets day and night, kind of like Wajanu. But anyway, his handle is @MuslimIQ. And he's also a fellow podcaster, which is awesome. He hosts a podcast called Recite Islam. First of all, welcome to the show, Qasim.
Thank you for having me, Rabia. Awesome to be here.
I'm very excited that you're here. I recently took a look, and you know what? You kicked me and Waj's ass in terms of Twitter followers. You are a big deal on Twitter.
You know, it's not that I'm a big deal. It's that I surround myself with good people, and you and Waj are two of those people. And I take cues from you guys, and I just try to learn and try to put out content that people will enjoy.
This is not a space for humility and modesty. If you do that again, let it be known your ass will be kicked, Qasim.
Fair enough.
I don't think a day goes by where you, first of all, I really urge all our listeners to definitely follow Qasim because his tweets are not like my tweets, which is kind of like snarky, like, oh, look at this. Oh, what an idiot, which is like half my tweets at least. They're actually very insightful. They're full of information and facts. And many of them just go like viral. I mean, like they're off the charts and like almost every day there'll be something and he's been retweeted by all. I mean, like, and so it's not about the tweets or the retweets. It's about like the information. And I really love sharing it and I share it all the time. So definitely check that out. But I want to also talk to you about your podcast. Since when have you been podcasting, Qasim?
So we started this about, I don't know, maybe 6 months ago. And we wanted to put out a podcast on Islam that was not this like very evangelically and like the bleaky podcast, and also one that wasn't just so into the weeds of like commentary and tafsir that you have to be a scholar to understand it already.
Oh dear God, you've already lost our audience. You said tablighi, you said tafsir.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
No idea what's going on.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. Like every podcast we saw had these really strange and you know unknown Arabic words, and we're like, look, there's got to be something out there that people can just connect to. Someone who just simply wants to know the basics can connect to. And so we decided to build this podcast with the Religion News Foundation. And we've done it in such a way that every episode is a story. We don't really get into these deep commentaries. If people have questions, we'll answer them. But we tell a story. We tell the story of Islam through the person who knew Islam best, and that's Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And so through his life and his example, we'll talk about important issues like, you know, racial justice and women's rights and economic justice. And because it's in a story format, it's been a really successful podcast so far. At least in the Islamic category, we've consistently been the number one podcast, which is pretty exciting on iTunes.
That's fantastic. Do you have a co-host or how does it, who's the we?
I do. So my co-host is a good friend of mine, Salam Bhatti, who's a poverty lawyer in Virginia. And so, you know, his career is also dedicated towards poverty law and poverty rights. So it was a natural fit. He and I actually used to host a radio show like 10 years ago in our mid-20s called The Real Revolution. And so that was kind of the training grounds. But, you know, talking to both of you right now, I realize we haven't had you guys on the podcast yet, and we need to change that in the near future as well.
That's really why I invited you, just for the reciprocity. But can you tell us?
For the listeners, tablighi and tafsir is basically an alternative to tabbouleh and hummus. So don't worry, just condom.
It's a total lie, total lie. Yeah. So we're all lawyers on the show today. But Qasim, can you tell us a little bit about your work in the law?
Absolutely. So it kind of oscillates between corporate law and human rights law. And, you know, I wanted to go to get my MBA. And my wife, God bless her, read my MBA essays. And she looks at me and she goes, this is the worst trash I've ever read in my entire life.
It's a good
like,
woman.
Yeah. I'm like, well, okay. So what do you recommend? She goes, well, you should go to law school instead. And I'm like, you know, I don't think law school is for me. And she goes, no, I'm not asking you. I'm telling you, you're going to law school. And that was literally the conversation. And so I went to law school, went to a great law school in Richmond, and worked in corporate America for about 3 or 4 years, 5 years, just to kind of get my bearings, understand what it means to be a lawyer. Because as both of you know, going to law school teaches you literally nothing about how to be a lawyer. So that kind of helped pay the bills, establish myself as a lawyer. And in the meantime, I was doing a lot of work with the Virginia Poverty Law Center, working in the Office of Domestic and Sexual Violence. I worked with an organization called Karama for several years in women's rights. And so now I work as an attorney. I take small cases, small business cases, but most of my work is in advocacy, in activism, and in working in immigration and human rights issues.
Awesome. Well, all three of us have experience in immigration. We're going to talk a lot about that because it's been a busy week on these issues and last night especially. But before we get into that, I want to start with just this really joyful New Year's tweet that the president put out this morning. about California. So let's go there. Wajahat, do you want to tell us what Trump had to say about California this morning?
Billions of dollars are sent to the state of California for forest fires that without proper forest management would never happen. Unless they get their act together, which is unlikely, I have ordered FEMA to send no more money. It is a disgraceful situation in lives and money.
And that's Donald Trump's tweet to the worst, the most deadly fire in California's history. And I'm a little bit biased because, as you guys know, my home state is California. I moved here 6 years ago. Just like Qasim, I listened to my wife and I moved here for my wife. But this fire devastated that state, guys. It scorched over 153,000 acres. That's an area larger than the city of Chicago. 88 people were killed. Thousands of people lost their home. And this is just one of the many fires in the past decade that has really kind of erupted in California, not due to bad forest management, right? He's mocking, you know, firemen, by the way, who risk their lives to fight this fire, which kills so many people. It's due to climate change. And before we get into it, I just want to remind the listeners again that in November, the Trump administration released a 1,200-page report on climate change where they said climate change is real and having a devastating impact on the economy, on our health, on America. And Donald Trump's response was, I don't believe it. So that's the situation we're at right now, that this man, this baby Christian, guys, this Christian has said this to punish California, a blue state.
Well, Qasim, first of all, I just want you to know that we love having Watch on the show, especially specifically for his Trump impressions, but
was scarily good. Like I'm really impressed by that. I was going to be my first comment, but you beat me to it.
As it was happening, I was thinking Qasim is probably never going to return. He's probably like, what is this show? What is happening here? But anyway, let me ask you, what do you think is motivating his obsession with the California? Like, first of all, he could just remain silent on this issue, right? Like, why do you think he keeps going back? There's a political motive here, right? And I don't even think it's like an attack on the science of climate change necessarily. Something else is going on. What do you think?
I think it goes back to, I forget who said it earlier, but that if the president really is a Russian asset, then their goal is going to be to create as much discord and dissension and distrust in this country as possible. And so, you know, working on that theory, and sure, call it a crazy theory, call it totally, you know, wacky and outside the realm of possibility. But working on that theory, nonetheless, this is what someone would do if they're trying to create discord and dissension and distrust. He's just trying to, you know, detract from issues that are important issues and finding ways to waste time. And it really comes down to, I think, creating a sense of exhaustion among the American public that, you know what, I just can't deal with this anymore. And so I'm just going to eventually let things slide that normally would cause, you know, a 5-alarm fire. That's really the only logical thing I can think of at this point.
But why specifically this? I mean, he can cause discord across the board, and he does with every other issue, but I feel like he keeps going back to California.
Well, California had the 3 million illegal votes, remember? Maybe this is retribution for that.
I think it's more simplistic than that. I mean, I think Trump is very predictable, and he's a very vindictive individual. He's very petty. And he comes from the Roy Cohn and Roger Stone school, right? That you never relent, you always attack. And if you look at California, it's become this bastion of resistance to Trumpism. Jerry Brown, senators, Kamala Harris, Hollywood. And so for him, it's an act of cruelty. And to quote Adam Serwer from his great article in The Atlantic, cruelty is the point. And also he thinks he's rallying up his base. But I'll tell you one thing, you know, I was born and raised in California. Never in my life did I ever think that Orange County, which was one of these red havens in California, would ever go blue. I remember we used to joke that like when Orange County goes blue, like that's a sign of Qiyamah, which is an Arabic word for like the judgment day, right? Armageddon. Mm. Well, guess what would happen in the midterm elections? Orange County went blue. And so what some people are saying is by Trump's attacks on California, which I think are mostly spurned by this type of malicious insecurity and vindictiveness on his part, it means the Republicans have completely lost that state. That's why I think it's going to happen. They have no shot now because that fire, again, devastated that state and people are still recovering. And he doesn't need to do this, but he chose to do it, Robbie and Qasim. It just shows you what type of man he is. So I know Qasim wants to take it to a meta level of Russia. We'll get to that later with a whole bunch of Russian news. But I just think this is who he is. He's a petty, vindictive man.
All right, I'm going to confess. I am one of those people who compulsively buys books. Either like actual hard copies or as an ebook format. I love books. I love collecting books and I don't always have the time to read them. In fact, I'm usually backed up by about 100 books deep. That's how far it goes. And I know a lot of you are like that. You collect books, but you just don't have the time to read them. But we have a new sponsor that will make this all go away and has solved this problem. Blinkist. Blinkist has solved your long list of must-reads once and for all. Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books, okay, books that have information and facts, and you've always wanted to know and learn from them, and they distill them down to the most impactful elements, so you can read or listen to these books in under 15 minutes, all on your phone. Isn't that kind of crazy? That's amazing. With Blinkist, you're going to expand your knowledge and learn more in just 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you could listen to it anywhere. I like to listen to Blinkist when I'm doing the dishes, when I'm going for a short drive. In 15 minutes, I have gotten all the information that I want from a book that I've held on to probably for years, never getting the time to read it. The Blinkist library is massive. They've got timeless classics like Think and Grow Rich and current bestsellers like Fire and Fury. My personal recommendation is to check out a fantastic book that I just listened to with Blinkist called Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. Now, I actually bought this book. I own this book, okay, in a hardcover, a year or two ago. I can't even remember. And it's just, I just haven't had time to read it. I had a baby, y'all. But I got to read it in just 15 minutes and distill all the most important elements by this Nobel Prize winning researcher. And it covers all phases of his career from his early days working on cognitive bias to his later work on happiness. It's really a must read for anybody who's interested in how our minds work. I love the book, Thinking Fast and Slow. So definitely check it out. 5 million people are using Blinkist to expand their minds 15 minutes at a time. So why don't you get started today? Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. If you go to Blinkist.com/45th, you can start a free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/45th to start your free 7-day trial. Blinkist.com/45th. Well, here's the other thing I wanted about this tweet. First of all, he says, I've ordered FEMA to send no more money. I mean, and that ties, I mean, I was thinking like, can he, I mean, at this point, I know like with the government shutdown happening, there are still essential employees that are, they have to show up for work. They're not getting paid. But essentially speaking, like is an agency like FEMA, I mean, what is it? Does anybody know? Like, is it still like operating like on a very essential emergency basis or?
I mean, to my understanding, most of the federal emergency agencies have some kind of a rainy day fund to make sure that they can still function in these kinds of situations. Like SNAP, for example, the food stamp program, just found, you know, they were going to be bankrupt by the end of the month. They just found another, I think, $4 billion to last them through February. So there's other funds that are available in these kind of emergency situations. And I think it's designed that way to anticipate if there is a shutdown, it can withstand a couple of weeks or a couple of months. I don't know what the FEMA budget is right now, but you know, I tend to agree with a lot of what Wajah had said there, that there is a lot of pettiness and vindictiveness in this space. And my question is, where is Congress in all this? Where is that accountability, and why isn't it coming? It just makes no sense to me that there's a complete, you know, abstention of any kind of, or abdication of any kind of responsibility from the people who are supposed to keep the executive branch in check.
You know, California Republicans, you know, who are, you know, politicians are kind of in a really sticky place with this. I mean, like, either they back up the president and then that's it, it's over for them locally, or they oppose him. And that's also going to be kind of tricky for them too. So he hasn't put them in an easy spot to figure out politically how they have to proceed on this. But it could just be that California's lost to the blue wave at this point, so it doesn't even matter. I just, before we move on, I just want to point out one thing, and that is that, you know, he keeps putting the blame on California, on the state agencies and local agencies for the management. But the majority of the acres of the forest and stuff out there, there's like 33 million acres of forest in California, 57% is actually owned and managed by the federal government. Only 3% is owned and managed by state and local agencies. And these are also not specifically forest fires. Yeah, they are. There's something called wildland urban interface fires, which is the space between like the forest and urban areas. And that's why so many families are losing homes. That's why so many suburbs and communities are in danger from these fires. But let's move on from that happy tweet that occupied. I mean, he kind of lost steam, I guess, after last night. He ended his night with a tweet congratulating himself over a excellent Oval Office address. So let's talk about that Oval Office address, which had a lot of hype before we actually heard it.
Yeah,
I was fully prepared that this guy is going to take this opportunity to declare a national emergency because he kept floating this idea. Yeah. Kind of nothing happened.
Well, I think the one funny thing that happened for me, aside from all the seriousness that we're going to talk about, but the Democratic response got higher ratings than the president's address.
Did you think it even merited a response?
I mean, yes, only because silence would have kind of been misconstrued or twisted by the president as saying, look, they don't even have a rebuttal to me. I don't think the response was very effective. I think they missed a lot there. But I think they should have had a response. How they did it, I think, could have been done better.
It was like the American Gothic painting. You guys ever seen that painting?
Yes.
The Mon, a farmer with a pitchfork.
Yeah.
And it was like slightly creepy, but I agree with Gossam that you needed a response because it gives you an opportunity to put forward another vision of border security and immigration, that contrasts Trump. But I do think that Alexandria Cortez's passion, and I believe she appeared on Maddow, that type of passion and those talking points should have been delivered, I think, by Pelosi or Schumer or another messenger. So it didn't necessarily hurt the Democrats, but they missed a very good slam dunk opportunity. Because this shutdown is going to break the record, I think, by the end of this week, right? The shutdown has lasted. The largest shutdown was in 1995, lasted 21 days under the Clinton administration. And Republicans at that time, with Newt Gingrich, true to form, were opposing the spending bill and wanted deep cuts to Medicaid and Medicare. That, by the way, torpedoed Gingrich's leadership and hurt the Republicans, right? So I think he's going to break the record. He breaks all the wrong records. And so they have actually a lot of equity here to play with, but they always kind of pull their punches. And I think a lot of people have stepped into the void, fact-checked him, and kind of debunked it. But I still think when it comes to immigration reform historically, Democrats keep punting it. And I think what we've learned now, Robbie and Gossam, is they can't punt it any longer. This is an opportunity. Put forward a bold, progressive plan on immigration reform. You have a foil here in Donald Trump. To me, this is the perfect opportunity.
Yeah, there's more to talk about when it comes to the response. And I mean, I guess another question is, like, when I say, did it even merit response? The real question is, did it even merit, like, for this stupid 5 or 10 minute, whatever it was, to be, you know, addressed, to be broadcast by, to be broadcast by, like, you know, it's one of those things where if a tree falls in a forest, did it even happen type of thing. If everybody just kind of ignored it, I wish the networks hadn't given him the space, to be honest, because this was just, these were just like talking points to his base. There was no policy there. There was no new, there's nothing new that we haven't heard a million times before. And in fact, it's interesting because there's reporting that says that in fact, he was not even interested in doing the speech. There's an announcement earlier that he's going to visit the border wall, but they're saying that he doesn't really want to do that. But his advisors, quote, are telling him, and I think those advisors are like anchors on Fox News who are saying to him that he needs to do these.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, and so anyhow.
Yeah, what I would have loved to have seen, what I thought would have been amazing, is instead of Schumer and Pelosi respond, have someone like Cortez or Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib respond. Could you imagine just the impact that would have had to have a woman of color be the rebuttal to Trump? I mean, basically the person that he fears the most and the person he demonizes the most. I mean, I think that would have, one, been an inadvertent or an indirect rebuttal in the sense that, you know, this is the future that you're afraid of. And two, I think that kind
the
of
the optics would have been very powerful.
Absolutely. And then they would have been able to just paint the story of immigration and of people of color just so much more effectively. And I think that would have rallied people a lot better.
This is one of the biggest problems the Democrats have. Not only can they not get their messaging right, they can't get their messengers right.
Yeah.
You're right. I mean, this whole thing, this whole address is about immigration, border security, migrants, about what this country is supposed to look like, who it's supposed to be made up of. And having, you know, God bless them, but having two white people stand up there, establishment, you know, folks were like it. You're right. The optics and the message would have been so much stronger. It would have been a complete rebuke of everything this man stands for if they had some of these freshman Congress people in there. But let's talk a little bit. So, you know, this was all kind of about the wall, right? This whole thing was about the wall. And according to a Vanity Fair article, Trump is kind of like banking everything on the wall. He thinks he cannot win in 2020 unless he gets this wall. People are saying it might be his Alamo, but there's no end game in sight necessarily. There's a former official who's in touch with the White House said that the problem, there's no end game. Right now, the White House is at a 7 on the panic scale. And if this thing goes past the State of the Union, they're going to be at an 11. Another prominent Republican who's close to Mitch McConnell said that Trump's handling of the shutdown is a total fucking chaos for this wall. All right, so let's go through some of the talking points. Waj, if you want to lead us into that, or I can, however you want to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember I was watching it in real time within a minute in. I'm like, oh, lie after lie after lie. And I tried
it to was back. Like 5 seconds in was the first
yeah,
lie.
Yeah, like 7 seconds in. So basically, the major, I mean, I also said you should play a drinking game each time he would say criminal or crisis, take a shot of alcohol, and you would have probably been dead of alcohol poisoning like by the second minute. And for us who don't drink, we just take mango lassi shots and we'd be in a coma. But basically, the main ones were, you know, a massive surge in illegal border crossings. That's false. Undocumented immigrants have caused an uptick in crime. That's false. Undocumented immigrants drain resources from this country. That's false. Undocumented immigrants take jobs. That's false. The drug claim, huge Pinocchio's on that, right? Like apparently the undocumented immigrants are bringing in drugs, which is why you need the wall. But, you know, we could fact check all of this. First of all, yes, drugs are coming, but they're coming through the legal ports of entry. A wall in no way, shape or form will actually reduce the drug trafficking, right, that comes from the southern border. Illegal border crossings have hit a historic 46-year low. And all the data shows, even from conservative think tanks like Cato Institute, that undocumented immigrants actually contribute more to the economy than they take. And unlike Donald Trump, they actually pay their taxes. So basically, you have fact after fact after fact that shows two things. Number one, there is no crisis at the border. I'm going to repeat this. There is no crisis at the border. And I think it's important for us when we talk about this to always mention that, because you don't want – Republicans are very good at branding certain phrases and terms, right? So we should always debunk border crisis. There's no such thing as border crisis. And the second thing is violent immigrant. We should debunk that as well, because foreign-born individuals and undocumented immigrants commit less crime in America than native-born Americans. So you and me and Qasim – are actually statistically more violent based on our the
fact. Oh, hell no. I was born in Pakistan. I'm safe.
I was also born in Pakistan, which
I am the violent, gun-toting, glue-sniffing American stereotype wearing a cowboy hat. But that's just some of them, right? And the last thing I'll say is just to show you how dangerous and misleading this Trump administration is, the DOJ, Trump's Department of Justice, right, came out with a report in 2018, which they proved the connection between terrorism and immigration. But guess what? They admitted that there were errors in that report. And they basically used wrong numbers and data to show like all these immigrants were like this wave of rapists were coming. But guess what? It was totally flawed data. So they finally admitted that, yes, our numbers were in error. But guess what, guys? They refused to correct it. True to form to the Trump administration. So that's just some of the lies that were mentioned in 9.5 minutes. And I tried my best in 2 minutes to debunk them. I probably missed something.
One of the things that occurred to me as I was listening, and he brought up specifically instances of undocumented immigrants who had committed violent crimes, you know, this young girl stabbed, this other woman raped and strangled and this and that. This is the kind of rhetoric and this is the kind of fear mongering that was used against Black men for a long time in terms of being a danger to white women.
Yeah. Yeah, it still is.
Yeah, it still is. You're right. And it just seems like this is he's just playing on these same kinds of fears and tropes. And then I think later, right after this, I'm not sure. But, you know, on Fox News, you see this one of the anchors. I don't know what her name is. I don't care. They're all the same to me. But, you know, white lady, blonde hair, about as much of your image of like what a female Trump supporter would look like could be kind of saying the same things. Would you want your sister and daughter raped? I'm like, oh, my God, this is like same shit, different flavor. It's like the same kind of idea. It's really horrific.
That was on Fox and Friends.
Yeah, it was on Fox and Friends. That's right. Qasem, and what are your thoughts? Did you watch it live last night?
I did. And you know, co-signed a lot of what Wajah had said, if not all of it. There's one thread by a guy on Twitter named, his Twitter handle is Stonekettle. He's a fantastic, thoughtful guy. He worked in the intelligence for many years in the military. And he brought up a point about the wall that I think a lot of people ignore. I certainly hadn't realized this. But he said that, look, let's assume we build this wall. This hypothetically, we build this 2,000-mile, you know, monstrosity, 30 feet tall and, you know, 10 feet wide, and you have all the barbed wire and everything that you would require of the wall. Because that in and of itself won't do anything. You still need to monitor the wall at all times, through drones, through cameras, through, you know, through dogs, through people. It would need to be monitored 24/7 because guess what? Otherwise, people will simply, you know, bring a ladder and find a way to climb over it. So if the idea is to monitor the border at all times, then why spend all this money on a stupid wall? Why not just monitor the border at all times? There's really no actual need for the wall in and of itself, because at the end of the day, you still need to have people monitoring it at all times. But they're not willing to do that. And the reason why they're not willing to do that is because the cost of doing something like that is astronomical. The effectiveness is stupid because that's not where the drugs are coming from. And they know all this. And despite all this, you know, those lies that were told last night that Wajah just did a really good job of knocking down are still being repeated over and over again. And that's one thing where I give people on the right credit. Republicans nowadays, I give them credit for this, that they will just repeat the same thing over and over and over again without paying any regard to whether it's true or not. It's the same thing as this claim of 4,000 terrorists. Like, we know it's a lie, but they've repeated it so many times. I'm sure you guys are getting trolls on Twitter responding to you as well, saying, well, there's 4,000 terrorists. And, you know, how do you even argue with that when they've just discarded all logic and any sense of reasoning?
They don't break rank. I mean, like Mitch McConnell put out a statement right after the address, basically backing up, you know, backing Trump up. I mean, this is, it's astonishing.
Well, Qasem and Ravi, real quick, it's worse because even when they're called out, right? Let's give credit where it's due. Chris Wallace called out Sarah Huckabee Sanders on this 4,000 terrorists coming from the southern border. And he said, no, it's actually 6 immigrants at the U.S.-Mexico border who are on the federal government list of known or suspected terrorists in 2018. Well, today, Fox and Friends kind of, again, tried to fact check Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And what she said was, it doesn't matter if it's 4 or 1 or 4,000. So it's like it's so egregiously shameful that not only do they double down, Ravi and Qasem, on the lie, even when they're called out by the lie, they just shift the post, right? The Overton window keeps shifting further and further to the right until we're going to like reach the twilight zone.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, would you buy a t-shirt for $50 if you knew it only cost $7 to make? And how often do you even know how much the clothing you buy costs to make? Well, pretty much never. But if you did, you wouldn't buy that t-shirt, and we wouldn't either. And that's why with Everlane, you actually never have to do that again, because you never overpay for quality clothing. Everlane makes only premium essentials, using the finest materials without traditional markups. And they tell you their real costs, so you know you're never overpaying. It's kind of amazing. Everlane wants you to know what you're paying for and why. They are radically transparent about every single step of the process, from the materials they use to the ethical factories they work with. And here's the thing, Everlane sells directly to you, so their prices are 30 to 50% lower than traditional retailers. Their clothes look better, cost less, and they last longer. And you can feel good knowing exactly where your clothing came from and how much it cost to make. A few of the products that I have gotten and I've loved, loved, loved from Everlane, and I'm telling you, these are the classic pieces that I'm going to use probably forever. I got two pairs of their Day Flat. It's a beautiful flat. It's gorgeous shape and just like the softest leather ever. And a clutch, this black classic fold over soft as butter clutch that I've carried to a number of places and gotten compliments on. I love it. The essentials are timeless. They're just what you're looking for. No frills, just premium quality. Right now, you can check out our personalized collection at everlane.com/45th, and you'll get free shipping on your first order. So check out Everlane. That's everlane.com/45th. Once again, everlane.com/45th, and get free shipping on your first order. Well, so one thing that he did mention, and I've seen this floated a couple times now by Trump or Trump supporters, is that Democrats want a steel wall. So we're going to give them that they requested a steel wall. But where did that come? When did I miss that? Or did this never happen?
I think it's just another thing that he made up of his own accord because he got called out on the concrete wall. He was asked, I think, recently by a CNN journalist that you promised a concrete wall. He said, no, I didn't. Obviously, he had. And so as a way of saving face, he's shifted to steel and started blaming the Democrats for it, and knowing full well that his base isn't going to fact check him on it, and they don't care. So again, it's one of those petty things that he just kind of pulled out of thin air because it's convenient.
In all fairness, he refers back to over 10 years ago when Schumer and other Democrats voted for 700 miles of fencing. But that, you know, obviously never passed, and that's not the same thing as a wall or beautiful steel slats. Another big lie. He said Mexico is going to pay for it. Mexico has refused to pay for it. And even with this new revised NAFTA, there's no way the wall is paying for itself. So that was another big whopper. A lie he said.
Well, first of all, that trade deal, it hasn't been passed by Congress. It's not ratified. It's not even. And on top of that, it actually doesn't include any new tariffs on Mexican goods. So even if it did pass, like, it wouldn't create any increased revenue. He also blamed specifically, and I think a lot of what happened last night was about the increasing severe consequences of the government shutdown. And he specifically blamed Democratic leadership for the shutdown, saying it's because they won't fund border security. Another fact check to correct that is that Democrats actually offered $1.3 billion for border security specifically, but not for a wall. So let's now talk about the shutdown. It is day 19. We are very close to beating a record. But so, you know, I don't remember anything about the shutdown under Clinton at all. I don't know if it was this precarious and hairy, but it feels like things are really disintegrating quickly right now with the shutdown.
Yes, we're going to break the record. 21 days, 800,000 federal workers are going to miss their paychecks. We already see, just last week, the story was that TSA agents were not showing up to work. They were taking sick days. The new story is that they're quitting. Also, Qasim, I'm glad you mentioned the snaps, right? Like, yes, it got renewed for February, but what's going to happen in March? That puts to peril 38 million low-income families. Also, what people fail to realize is they're not going to be able to pay their rent. So that's going to hurt the housing market. And also, HUD is affected, which also gives necessary money to low-income families. In addition to that, yes, Trump says somehow they'll get tax rebates. Let's see. But if those tax rebates don't come, that's about $140 billion. Of tax rebates that Americans are anticipating in a couple of months. Well, if you don't have that money, what does that do to the economy, right? So 800,000 workers, I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal, you want to pay your bills and you want to buy groceries for your families and you want to pay rent. So imagine what's going to happen to these people in a couple of weeks. And that's why, and what we have different, Roger.
And by the way, those are only the employees. That does not include the hundreds of thousands of federal contractors.
Right.
It doesn't include all the businesses that are impacted around the spaces where these people work. It doesn't include, like you said, all these services provided to the citizens and the impact it's actually going to have on Americans itself.
But you had leadership, Rob. Like, see, 1995, you actually had, even with the dysfunction of Gingrich, you still had some sort of adult professional leadership that was willing to compromise. With Trump, him deciding to do his first Oval Office address on this unnecessary, stupid wall, spreading lies for 9.5 minutes, and him saying that he needs this wall to win, and him tripling down on it in the midterm 2018 elections and getting wiped out in a blue wave tsunami, are we really confident that he's going to do the right thing for the sake of the American people?
Yeah. No.
Yeah, not at all.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about some of the widespread. It's interesting, you know, a few people, I've had folks tweet at me saying, folks who don't live in the United States saying, we don't understand how this works. Like, what is actually happening there? And how is this, like, how does a government shutdown even work? So I want to talk a little bit about how the broader impacts that it's not just people staying home and maybe not getting their paycheck. I mean, the first paycheck that would be missed by federal employees is this Friday. But let's talk a little bit about some of even the points you mentioned. Okay. You talked about the housing, like low-income housing. The IRS right now cannot verify tax returns for people who are trying to get loans to close on a house. You're trying to buy a house? Well, IRS has to verify that stuff before your mortgage can be approved by the bank. And they're not doing that right now. The FDA is not doing its routine inspections, okay? The EPA runs out of funds and furloughed about 95% of its employees. The National Science Foundation has suspended reviewing all grant proposals. So it's impacting postdoc fellowships. It's impacting students. It's impacting actual research. There's an amazing thread on Twitter by somebody named Amanda Diebert, or Diebert, it's D-E-I-B-E-R-T. And she said, you know, if you're currently working without pay during the shutdown or furloughed and you want to like tell us what's going on, give us your story. So, you know, a lot of people, I think hundreds of people commented underneath about like, you know, how it's impacting them as federal employees. For some reason, I can't pull up the tweet now.
I have it right here in front of me. Okay. If you're currently working without pay during the shutdown or are furloughed and willing to share, please comment and let people know what you do. I think it's important for everyone to understand the families and services that are currently impacted. It is vast.
Yeah. One of the tweets that like caught my attention was this. This guy says he's a healthcare recruiter. Okay, so he doesn't work for the government. He's a healthcare recruiter. They cannot verify I-9 documents because E-Verify is down. To explain that to folks who are not familiar with it, when you go apply for a job here, you know, the employer is obligated to make sure you are authorized to work in the United States. You're not undocumented. You have to fill out something called an I-9 form. They submit it to get verified with the E-Verify federal system. E-Verify, they can't do it. They won't do it. It's down.
Yeah, on the SNAP side, I want to comment one more thing on that because this is something that's been near and dear to my heart for a long time. Like, I think one thing to really be very clear about this is that with SNAP, it's not a matter of, well, we'll get you the food eventually. Like, you have a 3-hour window before kids need to eat, you know, a 4-hour window. I mean, this is not something you can delay even 24 hours without it having massive impacts and literally killing people. So this is not hyperbole to say that people will die unnecessarily over the stupid border wall if this thing isn't resolved quickly. And that urgency, it feels like, hasn't yet hit the members of Congress who are refusing to act and bring about some kind of a change in this gridlock right now.
It's hitting vulnerable Republican senators. That's one good thing. You have Cory Gardner of Colorado. You got Susan Collins of Maine and right. Lisa Murkowski. Like, once it starts, you know, I've said this before on this podcast, and I've said this right when Trump was elected. And I'm not saying this in a glib way or in a cruel way either. The only way Trump's base and Trump supporters will learn is, unfortunately, through pain. Immense pain and suffering. And it's only when these policies start affecting them, that's when they're going to wake up to it. And the New York Times just came out with an article talking about, like, you know, Trump supporters in Florida, and had some stunning quotes where they're like, well, now his policies are hurting us, and we were expecting him to hurt other people.
Yeah. And so it was so awful to read that.
Yeah,
but it's hurting the wrong people. Yeah.
Yeah, it's hurting the wrong people. And then also a couple of months ago when this trade war started, you had a Trump supporter in the Midwest, factory worker, who said, I didn't mind when he said all these things about the other groups, but now his words and policies are hurting me. So if this shutdown goes past 21 days, which I think unfortunately will, that's, again, 800,000 workers and everything you just mentioned, Rabia, and food snaps and food
speaking
stamps.
Speaking of Trump's base, you know, the agency that distributes farm loans and farm subsidies, well, they're shut down. So right now is like when the farmers actually start buying seed for the spring. If they're not going to get their subsidies, they cannot buy the seeds for the crop for this year if they can't have access to the loans. It is absolutely going to hit his base. But it's hitting everybody right now. It's hitting everybody. So how can this be fixed? If GOP leadership finally decides enough is enough, it's too painful for us politically to do this, and then Trump vetoes it, what are you going to do? I feel like he is willing to burn the country down along with himself.
Well, you know, there was a tweet a couple of years ago when Trump was elected that said that really, I think, summed it up well, that the framers of the Constitution anticipated a president like Trump. They didn't anticipate a Congress like the one that we have now. Yeah. And, mm-hmm. and that really is what it comes down to. I mean, we have a checks and balances system for a reason, and each branch of the government is designed to check the power on the other branch. And right now, when you have a Congress that abdicates its responsibility or just completely just, you know, disregards it altogether, it allows, you know, one branch to gain more and more power. And we're seeing that, right? We see an increasingly conservative bench. And like every night before going to bed, I pray for Justice Ginsburg, because by God, we need her to stay alive for all the important reasons for the next as many years as possible.
But everyone pray for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. If you are a Pakistani auntie listening right now, read some Quran and blow it in the direction. We'll also take Catholic prayers, Jewish prayers. All prayers are accepted.
And it's because of this lack of any kind of engagement. I mean, could you imagine if, forget even, you know, Obama, that's the easy one. But if Bush or if Clinton had done half the things that the current president has done, it's inconceivable that they would still be in office more than a couple of days afterwards.
Right.
But it's what Gossam's right about Congress, Rabia, because you need, you know, Congress can do something. They can override the veto with 2/3 majority in both houses. So if you can have actually Republicans and Democrats in the Senate and the House actually, you know, vote for a bill, which, by the way, there is something there that passed with bipartisan support, which will fund the government to August and give you a stopgap measure for DHS funding until February. It's something already there. It's just that Trump vetoed it, right? So will enough Republicans in the House and Senate finally step up? And that's why I go back to those vulnerable Republicans who, and that 2020 map, it does not look good for Republican senators, by the way. And you better believe that at the end of the day, between them saving their butt or going down on this issue, I think they might turn on Trump.
Like almost everybody out there, for years, no decades, my family has juggled old photographs and VHS tapes and little, I don't even know like how to name the medium anymore. We probably even have floppy disks with all kinds of old photographs on them and memories that we've stored and wedding videos and all those things. But nobody can ever had access to them. We've not had access to this stuff for years. It's just been a mess. Nobody was more thrilled than actually my father when I got all of these things digitized, an entire box, a lifetime worth of memories digitized with Legacy Box. Playing videos for my father that he hadn't seen in years, I mean, it brought tears to his eyes, and I was just so excited to be able to give that to him, really just as a gift. Not only were we able to revisit all of these memories, but we saved our family films and photos from being degraded and lost forever. These things were just kind of deteriorating in boxes and like unmanaged like photo albums where they weren't even sticking in the pages anymore. We couldn't play the recordings. I mean, does anybody even own a VHS recorder anymore or player anymore? So I got to be like a family hero and bring back lost memories, and it just brought so much joy to my dad this holiday. So Legacy Box will send you a big old box. You can decide on the size you want, and you fill it with your old home movies and pictures and just ship it out to them. They do the rest. They professionally digitize your moments onto a thumb drive. You can do it as a digital download or a DVD. It's got really easy to follow instructions. They even have safety barcodes. So every piece that you send to them, you put a little safety barcode on it so it cannot and will not get lost. You get all of your original recorded stuff back along with the perfectly preserved digital copies. And you get personalized updates at every step. So they'll send you emails with every step of the process as they digitize your memories. Legacy Box is the world's largest, most trusted digitizer of home movies and photos. Over 450,000 families have trusted Legacy Box with their memories, and they've got over a decade of experience. And most importantly, all the work is done by hand right here in the USA. There has never been a better time to digitally preserve your memories. So visit LegacyBox.com today and get started. Now, for a limited time, our listeners are getting an exclusive discount. Just go to LegacyBox.com/45th and you get 40% off your first order. That is a deep discount, folks. 40% off if you go to LegacyBox.com/45th. Once again, LegacyBox.com/45th and save 40% off today. Get started preserving your past. I want to move on to a couple of the other stories, but you know who's actually still getting paid? It's federal employees. It's our legislators. They're still getting paid. 64 legislators are turning down their paychecks, but they are still entitled to their pay. I want to talk a little bit about the first week of the freshman class and some of the names you mentioned, Rashid, and so many others. What did you guys think? I feel like a couple of names dominated, and they are the people, they are the women who terrify the right the most, I think.
Sandy dominated. You guys know Sandy?
Sandy can dance, man.
Sandy can knows the moves to Breakfast Club. Sandy can Instagram. Sandy can clap back.
They're Sandy obsessed.
Sandy has now mainstreamed what was once a Republican
idea,
plan to
right?
tax the rich under Eisenhower, that 70% tax on the super wealthy, which again was done by Eisenhower, who considered himself a progressive conservative, who was a two-term president, Republican. Now, and by the way, her plan, which was mocked like initially by Republicans, is backed by Nobel Prize-winning economists. And for the first time, you have people saying, huh, that sounds like a good idea. So each attempt they've had to take down Cortez, they've given her more of a mainstream platform. She was on 60 Minutes over the weekend. She called Trump a racist. She's dancing all over them. She's dancing so well and it's so relatable that now Kamala Harris and everyone else is like, hey, look at me. I dance too.
Right. You're right.
Rashida Tlaib went mainstream and Samuel L. Jackson retweeted her and called Donald J. Trump a mother effer. I think they're doing pretty good. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I have to co-sign that. And I think that, you know, there was a comment made by outgoing Senator McCaskill where she said, I'm not really sure what the hype is about people like AOC. And, you know, I had to bite my tongue, but I figured it wasn't worth it. She's on her way out. But, you know, that mentality of the Democratic leadership is what's the problem with the Democratic Party right now, in that they're disregarding the young people coming up, they're disregarding the women of color coming up, and they're doing it to their own detriment. And it's not going to be a sustainable model. If they really want to embrace these new freshmen, you know, politicians coming up, they should do so in a way that they elevate them as opposed to try to knock them down. You know, I think Nancy Pelosi, to her credit, is doing a good job of that. And I think there needs to be definitely more of that to ensure that the momentum that they've gained over the last 2 years isn't lost when it comes time for the 2020 election.
I think they feel threatened, but I'm also a little bit surprised at the right's kind of obsession with certain figures, with the new class of legislators. I think, like I said, I think these are the women who scare them the most. They're the kind of people they want to keep out of this country, and it's the changing face of leadership that is terrifying them. And you know what's funny is I keep forgetting when I think about, I mean, the fact that, you know, there are now kind of amazing two Muslim legislators in the House of Representatives. For some reason, I keep roping Cortez into it too. In my head, I'm like, oh, there's three. I'm like, oh, no, wait a minute, she's not. But they all kind of line up for me. Well,
Ayanna Pressley as well. I mean, she's on fire too. Right. I don't know if you saw her remarks this morning.
She's great.
It was fantastic.
I did not. Can you update us?
Yeah, I mean, it was a 1 minute remark where she called out the president pretty aggressively on his anti-immigrant rhetoric, and she used this phrase of, you know, today I rise for, you know, for the immigrant mother, for the child, for the worker, for, you know, it was a really powerful display of her leadership and her conviction. She spoke about how she and the president both have taken the same oath to uphold the Constitution and to protect all Americans, and how his actions have demonstrated that he has clearly broken his oath. But in that place, she promised that she will uphold her oath and keep fighting for these marginalized communities. So, I mean, a very powerful 1 minute display, I thought.
Fantastic. All right, so we have about 10 minutes to wrap up on some other major developments in the last week. And we're going to start off with Manafort.
All right, Paul Manafort. collusion, cough. Collusion, what?
Right.
Sorry, too soon. First of all, we're all attorneys here, so here's some unsolicited advice. If any of you are looking for defense attorneys, please find one that knows how to properly redact a document that will be made public.
No,
that
no,
does
no.
Not incriminate your client.
I'm gonna stop you there. You know why? Because I absolutely look. We are the three of us are attorneys. Tell me, how many times do you guys look at a document before you file it with an agency or a courthouse? I mean, like, how many times? Like, I know that lawyers will look at a document repeatedly for all kinds of things. Because when you do a court filing, you know how many things you got to make sure the page numbers are right. It's paginated. It's got, there's, you know, the margins are, there's so many goddamn details you have to make sure. I refuse to believe that that was not on purpose.
You think it was
deliberate? Has a team of lawyers.
Wow.
I think it was deliberate. And the reason, you know, I'll tell you why I think it was deliberate. I think it was deliberate because I think, and I was talking about this with another attorney. We both think that, and we both agree that we think that this was a signal to Trump, that this is like, this is what's going down. And they are still angling for that pardon from Manafort, but they are giving Trump a heads up without being able, because they can't communicate to him otherwise, like what's happening, right? Like, so this was, this is my theory, because I refuse to believe a team of lawyers and law clerks and everybody else who had to have touched that document didn't see that. It can't happen. Anyway, that's,
yeah, that's fascinating.
My theory.
I don't write that off. Usually I think conspiracy theories are kind of nutty, but that one actually, I'm willing to buy that, because what was revealed in the document is that Paul Manafort, who was the former campaign chair, not just a coffee boy of Donald Trump's presidential campaign, met with a Russian-linked operative and his business partner, Konstantin Kalimnik, during the course of the 2016 campaign. And in the meeting, they discussed policies related to the Russia-Ukraine relationship. And, wait for it, Manafort and Gates, the deputy campaign chair, who was also pled guilty, allegedly shared polling data about the campaign with Konstantin Kalimnik, who allegedly is an asset of Russia. And furthermore, Manafort and Gates asked Kalimnik to pass that data to Deripaska, Oleg Deripaska, the Russian oligarch, who is, again, very close to Putin and Kremlin, and who has claimed that Manafort owed him money from a failed business venture. For those of you who have forgotten, in the 2016 Republican National Convention, at the last second, you guys remember that there was a controversial change in the language when it came to the Republican Party's platform on Ukraine, which took away damaging language, ostracizing Russia for their annexation of Crimea. Well, guess who was the campaign chair at that time?
Manafort.
Paul Manafort, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is actually way more damaging to Trump and the Trump campaign, and basically gives tremendous ammunition to collusion, much more so than the Trump Tower meeting. And speaking about the Trump Tower meeting, I know we're going to forget this because there was so much news. I have to mention this also. In another development just this week, the Russian lawyer who met with Manafort, Jared Kushner, and Donald Trump Jr. at the Trump Tower meeting was also charged with obstruction of justice in an unrelated case. Federal prosecutors in Manhattan said that lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya, I hope I got that pronunciation correct.
That's pretty good.
Pretended to a federal judge that she was purely a private defense lawyer, when in fact, wait for it, she was working with the Russian government to thwart the civil prosecution of a Russian company. Mm-hmm. All of this is pretty damn big news.
Yeah. What does this mean, though? I also read, by the way, I read, I think it was part of the same filing where his Manafort's lawyers are saying that, you know, he's being held in solitary and he's very sick and weak. He's been confined to a wheelchair and all that. But basically, this kind of shows that he's really screwed, right? I mean, he is screwed. And as screwed as he is, I mean, he'll get the pardon from Trump. What does this mean for others?
Well, you know, I think there's a couple of things. One, if this is able to stick, and there's a big if there, because, you know, if Trump does pardon him and if there is a Supreme Court ruling that permits him to pardon state crimes, none of it could stick. But this really will set a precedent for a future that will be, I think, good for our country. One of the big mistakes, I think, that we find in American history is that Nixon was pardoned, or he was protected from prosecution of those crimes. And I think that was a big mistake, because, you know, if due process of law had gone through for Nixon, then it would have prevented this from happening right now. But because he was allowed to go unpunished for his crimes, it created essentially a breeding ground for this to happen again. And if it's not caught this time, if something happens where, you know, there's one theory out there that, you know, before the end of the year, Trump will resign in exchange for amnesty for him and his family.
Apparently, Giuliani has been saying that behind the scenes.
So, but if that happens, then all you're doing is kicking the can down the road, and something even worse is going to emerge in 5 years, in 10 years. So, you know, I think the message of what it means for the future really depends on what the turnout ends up being over here. And I think anything short of holding those who colluded responsible is going to be a death sentence for our democracy in the long term.
Yeah, on a federal level, it's looking unlikely, especially with some news we got this morning, and that is the impending departure of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. So let's close out today, talk about this. And Wajahat, let's do Rosenstein in like 60 seconds.
Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has told people close to him that he expects to depart the Justice Department if a new attorney general is confirmed, and that most likely will be William Barr, who was also attorney general under Papa George Bush. There's no concrete plans in place right now or a timeline, but that is the breaking news. And that's pretty big news also for the Mueller investigation, because he is personally overseeing, was personally overseeing the Mueller investigation, because then Attorney General Jeff Sessions had to recuse himself. And now acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker, shady as hell, is overseeing it. He has a lot of potentially ethical violations. Namely, he auditioned for the role on CNN by promising to limit or reduce the Mueller investigation. He also doesn't believe in Marbury versus Madison and thinks all judges should be Christian, and also took part in a business venture that is currently being investigated. But other than that, great guy to be attorney general. He's probably going to be replaced by William Barr, who, by the way, also has been critical of the investigation, also decided to write a memo and distribute it, talking about how the Russian investigation was fatally misconceived. And also, by the way, like Brett Kavanaugh, has a very expansive view of executive privilege. So that gentleman might be the new attorney general. And Rod Rosenstein, who has been attacked personally by Donald Trump, most recently in December, where Trump called him, quote, totally conflicted, he's going to be out. And so that is a little bit troubling. But the good news is most people are saying that Rosenstein and many others think that Mueller is about to finish up his investigation. So let's hope for the best.
Any thoughts on that, Qasim, before we wrap up?
And this is the last thing I'll say is I'm still not convinced we should be putting our faith in Mueller. I think that's just too risky. I think
that's heartbreaking.
It sounds too easy just to rely on him that he's going to resolve it, because ultimately Trump has too much control over that. That our faith needs to be in Congress, where the president has no actual, you know, legal control over. And so it's a question of do you trust the investigator who is clearly doing the right thing, but Trump can fire him? Or do you trust Congress, who is not doing the right thing, but Trump has no actual control over them? So, you know, let's hope we score at least 1 out of 2, preferably 2 out of 2, but anything but 0 out of 2.
Sounds good. Well, thank you so much for joining us this week, Qasim. Can you tell our listeners once again how they can find you online?
Yeah, definitely. You can follow me on Twitter at MuslimIQ, and you can check out our podcast at Recite Islam. We drop new episodes every Tuesday and Friday.
Watch, thank you also very much for bringing us up to date on how our democracy continues to crumble. I'll end this episode by saying,
only for the good news. I make everyone feel better.
Right. I'm just going to close out by saying, impeach the motherfucker. All right, guys. Talk to you in 7 days. Thanks so much.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. And you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.